Welcome to The Locked Room, stories from the golden age of mystery and crime fiction. I'm Mardell, and it's time for part two of The Scent of Almonds by Hulbert Futner. We did not linger long over the azaleas. Madame Story pleaded that the long railway journey had given her a headache, and we returned to our rooms. But I had no headache, and I couldn't rest quiet there. It was too painful to have to sit by and watch young lives being wrecked without doing something about it. But what could you do? In such matters, any interference from outside only hastens the catastrophe. My room had a French window opening onto the encircling porch, and I went out that way and dropped over the rail to the grass without anybody seeing me. Notwithstanding the general cussedness of the human situation, I couldn't help but take pleasure in the beautiful surroundings. April on the Georgia island was like June in the north. There were flowers everywhere. I struck back between the great oaks to the golf course and climbed the grassy slopes to a point where I could obtain a wide view of the sea on three sides of the island. It was indescribably lovely, a sky of turquoise, with clouds around the horizon like big spoonfuls of Charlotte Russe, the green island with its wide beach of yellow sand and the sea, dark as sapphire, with a few motorboats to give the scale of its immensity. Behind me, the view was cut off by the dark woods running right across the island. This was the shooting preserve. I still had more than an hour before lunch, and I continued my walk in that direction. It proved to be a virgin forest untouched by axe or fire, and the greenish twilight under the tall trees was very pleasant after the brilliant sunshine. I had never seen such a forest. Great trees of many varieties that I could not name, all linked together with creepers and thorns. The palmettos which crowded every interstice gave it a tropical character. I believe that these dense tracts are called hammocks in the south. I was following a wide and well-beaten path in the brown earth, one of the bridle paths, I assumed. It twisted so much, I could never see more than a few yards ahead. Occasionally, I saw birds flitting silently across the openings. No songbirds. The silence was different from any silence that I had ever known before. Thrilling. It can be imagined, then, what a start I got when I suddenly heard human voices in the hammock, and what is more, voices charged with passionate emotion. The sound set my own heart beating fast. I stopped short in the path, of two minds whether to turn home or go forward. The voices died away. I went on, and soon I could hear them again. Suddenly I recognized them as the voices of Wynn Bucknell and Lila Dean, and I pulled up again, blushing all over. I was in a difficult position. Every natural instinct in me revolted against playing the eavesdropper. But on the other hand, it was clearly my duty to learn everything I could about the situation and report it to Madame Story. After a struggle with myself, I went on. For a while I did not come closer to the voices, and I judged that they must be walking along ahead of me in the same direction. I could not make out what they said. To my surprise, the man's voice was angry, the woman's pleading. This seemed to put a new aspect on the situation. It sounded as if Layla was crying. I could scarcely believe it. Occasionally, a word or two reached me. Wynn cried out harshly, "That's not love!" Evidently, she had asked him a question, and he answered hopelessly, "God knows!" Then I got a suggestion of the man's low, savage cursing and Layla's sobs. and they were a little too heartbreaking. I suspected that it was all put on. Later he said desperately, "What good would it do?" And Layla replied, "You are throwing me to the wolves." How I wanted to warn him that she was fooling him. In the end, I heard him say in reserved tones, "All right, I will, but..." He lowered his voice and the rest was lost. But Layla said, and her voice was purring with satisfaction now, "I'll win you yet." I increased my pace in order to get a little closer. At the same moment, they must have turned around and started back, for we came face to face at a bend in the path. It was an awkward moment. The man passed me with sullen indifference. His dark face was drawn and streaked, all white around the lips, a terrible sight. Layla was smiling until she saw me. She stopped and demanded in a shrill voice, "What are you doing here?" "The same as you," I retorted, "taking a walk." Her face worked with rage like a child's. "You lie," she cried. "You're trying to spy on me. A dirty little hired spy. That's what you are, yes. And your high-toned mistress, that goes for her, too. Spies, snoopers. How dare you put yourselves in an equality with decent people? Go back amongst your own kind, yes, and you can tell her I says so, too." "What are you afraid of?" I asked quietly. "Afraid?" She gathered herself up for a fresh torrent of abuse, but Wynne shut it off by saying contemptuously, "Come on, Layla, you're making a fool of yourself." I waited to let them get out of the way. When I came out of the woods, they were nowhere to be seen. I hurried back to the clubhouse, and returning to my room in the same manner that I left it, immediately went to my employer and told her what I had heard. She listened with an inscrutable smile. "Times have changed, my Bella," she said coolly. "She will find it rather more difficult to get away with that sort of thing nowadays." That was all I could get out of her. A few minutes later, we were all gathered in the lounge again, waiting for the luncheon gong, that is to say, all except Layla. Wonderful are the usages of good form. Everybody had ironed out his face, and there was an exchange of laughing and formal talk back and forth. A stranger could never have guessed the existence of the dark and painful passions that distracted our little company. I now saw Leavitt O'Malley for the first time. A tall, well-turned-out man, he was very vain in his youthful appearance, and overplayed it somewhat. He was much too sure of himself for my taste. I disliked him at sight. Even in social conversation, he fixed you with the overbearing eye of a cross-examiner. He did most of the talking. "Eloquence alone is not sufficient to win a man success at the bar," he said. "You have to study your judges. When I throw a party, I always make a point of asking a judge or two. You never know when you may have a case before them, and I take care to put the prettiest women beside them. That's how I throw my bread on the waters." He laughed and looked around for applause. Such was O'Malley's style. When Bucknell was seated on the other side of the lounge, making believe to read a newspaper with a hard, blank look. In front of the fireplace, Elsie and Hal were each perched on an arm of the same chair, both looking spent and done. They bore an extraordinary resemblance to each other, almost as if they had been twins. I judged from their attitude that they had made up after their quarrel. Elsie was now wearing a more formal dress of crisp green organdy. It was fastened at the breast with an old-fashioned enamel brooch, white violets on a black background. In a little while, Layla came running down the stairs, all life and gaiety. Like most of her actions, it was a carefully worked-up stage effect. She had changed to a smart tweed traveling suit with a rakish little brown hat and a green lizard skin handbag under her arm. She went to Wynne and leaned over him caressingly. "Put up your paper, stupid," she said, and then in a tone of surprise, "Why, you haven't changed yet." Her proprietary air was something new, and nobody in the room missed it. Wynne lowered the paper and smiled stiffly. He had the look of a man who had steeled himself for the end. "Won't take me 10 minutes to get ready," he said. The room became tense. I think everybody knew what was coming. My heart sunk like a stone. "Have you told them?" she asked. "No," said Wynne doggedly. She faced us with a pretty air of confusion. "Well, that is, Wynne and I have an announcement to make," she said and hesitated, tracing the pattern of the rug with her pump. "We have decided to get married." Nobody said anything. "I hope you won't think it's rude if we run away from you directly after lunch," Layla went on. "We want to get in a few days' honeymoon before Wynne has to go back to the office." The ghastly silence persisted. At such a moment, one's eye is always caught by some perfectly insignificant thing. All I was aware of was that the stair runner was pulled up on the fourth step from the bottom. "Somebody will trip over it," I kept saying idiotically to myself. "Somebody will trip over it." It was Madame Story who broke the silence. She was afraid of an explosion from General Southam, whose face was livid with rage. "Congratulations, both of you," she sang out. "May you live long and prosper." In the first moment, I could not bear to look at Elsie, but I heard her cross the room, and my eyes were dragged after her. It was the bravest thing I ever saw. She was as pale as paper, but her chin was up, eyes and lips smiling. She offered her hand to Layla and Wynne in turn. "I wish you the greatest happiness, both of you," she said without a tremor. Layla took her hand with a hateful smile, Wynne like a wooden man. The scene was too much for young Hal. He slunk out through the corridor. The gong sounded for lunch. The meal that followed was the worst thing I ever had to sit through. The forms of friendly talk were kept up. I got so nervous I scarcely knew what I was saying. Even Layla could not really have enjoyed her triumph. Wynne kept his face all right, but once or twice I caught him glancing at his bride with a pure, cold hatred that made me feel a little sick with apprehension. The dining room was a pleasant apartment back of the lounge, semicircular in shape, with a porch outside overlooking the golf course. All the tables had been cleared out, except the one round for 8, which was pushed up close to the windows in the middle. We were waited on by 2 perfectly trained men, and what we ate, I never could tell you. It seemed to go on forever. The seating arrangement, which was accidental, could not have been worse. Madame Story was facing the windows, with Wynne, Layla, and Levitt O'Malley on her right, General Southam, Elsie, and Hal on her left. I was seated opposite my employer. This left the 2 parties to the quarrel, as you might say, lined up and facing each other. Layla was full of her plans. "We'll hire a car in Stockmar," she said. "It will be quicker than the train. If Wynne drives, we can catch the Royal Palm at Middlebridge tonight. Wynne will have it flagged. On Wednesday morning, we will go down to the municipal building, get our license, and be married by an alderman on the spot, just like any runaway pair."
"How romantic," said Madame Story dryly.
"I'm afraid you're cynical," said Layla sweetly.
"About some things I am."
"About getting married, for instance?"
"I would never set up my opinion against yours," said Madame Story.
Perhaps you consider marriage an unnecessary formula, said Layla.
Oh, no, returned my employer blandly. Marriage is a woman's guarantee of alimony. As was natural, the men did not play up to the situation as well as the women. Excepting Leavitt O'Malley, who had no particular stake in it, they were silent and surly throughout the meal. General Southam kept his eyes down. When he raised them, they blazed with anger at Wynn. Hal looked in his plate, too, only occasionally glancing at his sister, as if in fear that she would break down. Elsie was wonderful. She kept her head up, smiling, watching to see that everyone was well served and joined in the talk with perfect naturalness. God knows what it cost her. Her smile was the most tragic thing I have ever seen on a young face. However, most people do not look below the surface of things. The fact that she smiled was enough for them. Layla had a horrible fascination for me. She was like a great actress, glowing with emotion and yet mistress of herself all the time. It was not love which lifted her out of herself, but hatred. I suppose women had always hated Layla, and she returned the feeling with interest. She hated us, all three. It was for the benefit of us women that she paraded her triumph. It is difficult for me to write of the frightful conclusion of that meal. As I approach it, my heart begins to beat suffocatingly again. When the waiters brought in the dessert and the coffee machine, Elsie dismissed them. "We'll ring if we want anything," she said. They went out and we did not see them again. Dessert consisted of some sort of iced cup and a silver basket of little cakes covered with a thick icing of marzipan. There was some talk about the cakes, I remember. "These are perfectly delicious," said Layla as her beautiful white teeth met through one of them. "Yes, aren't they?" said Elsie. "Since the chef learned that we liked them, he's been sending them every day." "I never could get too much marzipan," said Layla. "I love almonds in every form."
"It's wonderful what a woman's stomach will stand," said Mr. O'Malley jocosely. "Almond paste on top of a full meal. The cakes alone would be sufficient to keep a strong man going."
"Oh, dry up, father," said Layla, finishing her cake. "I am fond of marzipan myself, or I was until that day. And I nibbled at one of the cakes, but it seemed to choke me." At this moment, Elsie happened to glance out of the window. "Look," she said, "what sort of birds are those?"
"Woodcock, by Jove," said Mr. O'Malley.
One by one we rose and went out through the French windows to the porch. A covey of woodcock, on their way north, attracted by the solitude and the silence surrounding the clubhouse, had lighted in the grass, where they were busily looking for worms. One rarely sees this plump and handsome little bird, and we were all interested. Only Layla, I remember, seemed bored. She was the last to come out onto the porch, and instead of looking at the bird, she applied fresh lipstick. While we watched, Elsie looked back into the dining room. "Oh, the coffee's boiling over!" she exclaimed and ran in. Her cry alarmed the birds, and they took flight. We watched them out of sight and then straggled back into the dining room. Some of us sat down again, some remained standing. You can picture the scene. Lunch was over, the napkins thrown down anyhow, chairs pushed back. Elsie was busy with a coffee machine. There was a cake on her plate. I remembered having seen it there when we went out. Mr. O'Malley was standing back of his place. He took out his cigar case and moved around, offering it to the other men. General Southam accepted one. The other two declined. Madam Story offered her cigarette case to Layla. Layla shook her head, smiling. "Not yet," she said. "I'm going to eat another, though I die for it." She indicated the cake which was on her plate. And then it happened, with the awful suddenness of a hammer stroke. Still smiling, she picked up the cake daintily between thumb and forefinger and conveyed it to her mouth. A little cube, 2 inches long, covered with green icing. Her white teeth met through the middle, and she crunched it once, with just the expression of a child who pops the sweet into its mouth. And then an awful look came over her face. She clutched her throat. She had no time to spit the stuff out, no time even for a cry. She went dead just as quick as that. Dead, without a sound. Toppled over sideways in her chair and crashed to the floor. Already, when the men reached her side, that beautiful, quick flesh was clay. Dead. 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 The suddenness and the silence of it was awful. I must pass quickly over the next few minutes. Most of us were reduced to a state of complete hysteria, even some of the men. Such scenes are not pleasant to remember. Madame Story, with a face as white and set as marble, took command of the situation. No man challenged her right. When the servants ran in, attracted by the cries, she sent the first to the one telephone to summon a doctor, though we all knew that it was too late for a doctor, and the second man to the landing stage to send off the speedboat to fetch him back, since the club boat could make the round trip in less time than anything else could go one way. Mr. O'Malley, quite beside himself with rage and grief, insisted that the police should be sent for also. "Better wait," said Madame Story quietly. "The speedboat can go right back for the police, if it is necessary." She then ordered the French windows closed and forbade any of us to leave the room. The servants were kept out. We sat and stood about the room, blind with horror. Madame Story went down on her knees beside the dead woman and smelt her lips. The half of the cake that Layla had not eaten lay on the floor. Madame Story smelt that also and put it aside on a plate. She smelt the cakes remaining in the basket. "She was poisoned with hydrocyanic acid," my employer said gravely, "or prussic acid, as most people call it. It smells like almonds. Consequently, Layla could not detect it on the icing of the cake. The other cakes have not been poisoned." "Poison? Poison?" cried O'Malley, his voice rising almost to a scream. He whirled on the Southams. "One of you did this," he shouted. "You all hated her. By God, you shall burn for this, however high placed you are." General Southam's face turned dark with anger. "Speak to me," he cried. "Leave my children out of it." O'Malley was incapable of listening to him. "Prussic acid," he cried. "It couldn't have been here on the island. It was brought here for this purpose." "You fool," returned Southam. "When we came, we didn't know you were going to follow us." "No, but you've been to the mainland since we got here," snarled O'Malley. They seemed to be ready to fly at each other's throats. Madame Story stepped between them with her cold, self-possessed air. "Gentlemen, if you please," she said in a voice that compelled them to listen. "If this comes to a brawl, the evidence will be destroyed and the murderer will go free." Both men quieted down. Madame Story addressed herself to O'Malley. "Your feelings are excusable," she said, "but you must know that you were not in a fit state to investigate this matter. Will you leave it to me?"
"You aided her too," he muttered.
"You shall see for yourself whether I can be fair or not," she said coolly. He turned away with a gesture, signifying acquiescence. Meanwhile, the body was still lying huddled on the floor, just as it had fallen. The table had been pushed a foot or so to one side, and all could see what lay there. To all of us, there seemed to be a kind of desecration in leaving the poor body exposed and untended. O'Malley groaned when his eyes fell on it.
"Couldn't we pick her up and carry her to her room?" he asked.
Madame Story shook her head gravely. Not until the police have viewed her, but we could put some of the chairs together and lay her upon them, she added. This was done. The girl's face was shockingly distorted.
Oh, how awful she looks, how awful, groaned her father.
Madame Story covered the face with her handkerchief. That will pass, she said quietly. Death is kind.
Now, as to the poison,
cried O'Malley, turning to the Southams. Please, said Madame Story, you agreed to leave this to me. I already know where the poison came from, she added gravely. Several voices cried, Where, where? Madame Story looked with infinite sadness at the boy Hal. You tell them, she said. The boy's endurance snapped. He clapped his hands over his face and dropped on a chair, choking and sobbing.
Yes, I had it. I had it, he stammered. Oh, God, this is too awful. I can't bear it.
It was an ugly shock to the poor father.
Hal had it, he said hoarsely. Hal? You?
He turned in confusion to Madame Story. How did you know Hal had it? I saw the bottle of hydrocyanic acid on his table when I was looking at the butterflies this morning.
What did you want it for? General Southam demanded of Hal.
To kill my specimens, faltered the boy. It's the best thing. Everybody uses it.
How did you get it? Cried the general. Who helped you? Why didn't you come to me?
I thought you'd object.
Who helped you to get it?
Well, what does it matter? Stammered Hal. It's all so long ago. It has nothing to do with this.
Who helped you to get it? Persisted the general.
I won't tell you.
Wynne spoke up unexpectedly. Wynne, like the rest of us, had been shocked almost into a stupor, but he evinced no grief at what had happened. He kept away from the dead body.
He said now, I helped him to get it, sir. I saw no harm in it. Hal has a genuinely scientific attitude towards his work. Anyhow, Hal had it, put in O'Malley with cruel satisfaction. And Hal was perfectly familiar with the properties of prussic acid. He knows how it paralyzes the respiratory centers. As to the motive for the crime, that is obvious to all of us. He turned to my employer. Need we look any further, madam?
She put him off with a gesture. Bella, go fetch the bottle from Hal's room, she said to me. The boy had managed to get control of himself again.
There's no use, he muttered. It's not there now.
Where is it?
I don't know. Somebody carried it away.
O'Malley laughed hatefully.
That somebody was himself, he said, just before lunch when Layla made her announcement. I saw him go to his room. He got it then.
No, no, stammered Hal. It was already gone then.
Stand up, commanded Madame Story. Hold your hands above your head. My employer and I searched him thoroughly. The bottle was not upon him, nor anything else that could have carried part of the poison.
Who took it from your room? Asked Madame Story. I don't know, he said with a ghastly face.
You are lying, she said quietly. Anybody could see it. Don't you see that you are making matters worse?
Do you think I did it? He cried wildly.
Well, did you? Asked Madame Story.
No, no, he cried. I swear it.
Then who got the poison?
I don't know.
Wynne was sitting back from the table, bowed over in his chair with his arms on his thighs. He raised his stony white face and said, The kid is just trying to shield me. He brought me the bottle of poison himself shortly before lunch and asked me to put it in a safe place. It was too dangerous to be lying around, he said.
Oh, Wynne, why did you say anything? The boy burst out.
Easy, warned the older man. But Hal could not hold it in.
Wynne didn't do it,
he cried desperately. "He couldn't have done it. Wynne isn't afraid to face anything. Only a coward would kill by poison."
A grim smile twisted the man's lips. "You're not helping me any, old fellow," he said.
"Nobody has accused Wynne of the crime," said Madame Story.
"Accuse Wynne?" cried O'Malley, staring in astonishment. "Why should anybody accuse Wynne? Wynne was in love with my girl. They were..."
He suddenly pulled up. Something in Wynne's awful stillness raised a doubt in his mind.
"You were in love with her, weren't you?"
he cried. Wynne made no answer. His dark eyes stared straight ahead of him, unseeing, haunted. It was answer enough.
"If you weren't in love with her, what were you marrying her for?" demanded O'Malley.
No answer from Wynne.
"For her sake," murmured Madame Story, with a nod towards the body extended on the chairs. "You had better not push that line of questioning." O'Malley passed a hand over his face. His debonair quality had gone. He suddenly looked his age.
"Oh, my God," he muttered. "Oh, my God."
Then he flushed with renewed rage. "You too," he cried at Wynne. All of you." He swept out his arm. "All against her. You have betrayed her and killed her amongst you."
When his violence had spent itself, Madame Story resumed her questioning at the exact point where she had dropped it.
"When Hal brought you the bottle of poison, what did you do?" she asked Wynne.
"I did what he asked me to," Wynne replied woodenly. "I pressed in the cork as far as it would go and dropped the bottle into my bureau drawer. I hid it under the socks and ties."
"And it is there now?"
"So far as I know, it is."
"Is your door locked?"
"No, I've never locked it."
"Where is your room?"
"It is number 14, first door on the right at the top of the stairs."
Madame Story looked at me. "Go and see, Bella." I left the room. In the lounge, the manager of the club and several of the upper servants were hanging about in a bad state of nerves. Their eyes begged me for information as to what had happened, but of course, I had to keep my mouth shut. I ran upstairs. I may as well say at once that the bottle of poison was not where Wynne said he had put it. There were not so very many possible hiding places in his room. Nothing was locked up, and I searched them all. Nothing. When I returned to the dining room, they were all sitting about unnaturally still, like waxworks. The dead body extended on the chairs was no stiller. The last disclosures had brought a ghastly look into General Southam's handsome face. However, I was glad to see that he was sticking by his son, his hand rested on the boy's shoulder. The only movement in the room was the smoke rising from Madame Story's cigarette. I made my report. Nobody appeared to be surprised. Madame Story said to Wynne politely, "Will you permit us?" He immediately stood up and raised his arms, and we searched him. We found nothing to the purpose. He sat down as woodenly as he had risen. My employer then, with a whispered word to me, to watch that nobody moved from his place, set about searching the room. She had reduced the act of searching to a science. In her mind's eye, she laid off the room into small squares and finished with one before proceeding to the next. She did not find the bottle nor any receptacle, however small, that might have conveyed a drop or two of the poison. She went out on the porch and searched there, and searched in the grass below the porch. She returned to the room with empty hands, and lighting a fresh cigarette, paced back and forth. Her face gave nothing away. But I know her pretty well, and I could see that she was stumped at that moment. The cake must have been poisoned after it was brought in, of course. And the baffling question was, how had the poison been conveyed into the dining room? Join me next week for the conclusion of The Scent of Almonds. Until then, beware of footsteps in the dark.